Michelle, welcome. Officially got to welcome you. Thank you, Brian. Konigsberg, that's also a beer. Okay, and you're from the Konigsberg family. You are from the Konigsberg family?
I'm not from the
family.
The creators of beer.
Oh. I couldn't resist. I'm a Macmillan. So people always go, oh, Cargill Macmillan's? I'm from Minneapolis. And I go, I wish Cargill Macmillan's. They're the multi-billionaires of Minneapolis. I'd have a $3 billion a year desk job if I was at Cargill Macmillan. Also not Macmillan Publishing either. Richfield Macmillan's. That's what we go by. But so I always have to ask, you know, on the last name. So today we are immersed in a powerful story of our history as we celebrate 60 years of our church, Faith United Church of Christ. Today is a day to celebrate that part of the story where we look back on our history and all that has comprised our journey over these past 60 wonderful years. But we would be remiss if we did not also look back and situate ourselves in the larger story that we are a part of, not only of the United Church of Christ in general, which I'll talk more about in a bit, but the story that began in a Galilee far, far away. Okay, in a Galilee far, far away. I get that it's early. In a Galilee far, far away, we're on dusty, pretty far away. We're on dusty roadways, along riverbanks, on hills, and in gardens, and then on so many occasions around tables of hospitality over 20 centuries ago, an itinerant preacher struck out on his own. He amassed a following and he changed the world through upending all norms and laws of society, of the society of the time, with a message of love, hope, and peace. So our story, we have to go way back. Our story begins with this Jewish preacher named Jesus, who told stories of his own, stories of justice, of compassion, of equity for all people, like our stoles here. Our story begins with a man who spoke God into the world by imploring people to do the simple thing like love their neighbors, no matter who they are, as themselves, or to forgive their enemies, no matter who they are, or to sell their possessions and give the proceeds to the poorest, no matter where they are. That's been a rather difficult one, hasn't it? Our story began with a man who taught on hillsides in blistering sermons about the first being last, about blessings on the peacemakers, not the powerful warmongers, and about how we are to do unto others as we would have them do unto us. Our story begins with these admonitions and commands from the very one who manifested a God consciousness like the world had never seen to that point, who challenged the world to newness and goodness, and because of the difficulty and challenge of his message, was silenced. Or so the powers that be thought. That's where we need to begin our story today. And yet, that execution of Jesus could have been the end of the story, right? That could have been the end of the story. But the story continued in small communal gatherings that would meet weekly shortly after Jesus was executed, as people gathered to keep his memory alive and celebrate that vision that he unleashed on the world. Our reading from the book of Acts that Peg just read tells us how these early Jesus followers met regularly for teaching and fellowship and breaking bread and praying together and sharing meals in their homes with glad and joyful hearts, for Jesus introduced a new story into the lives of the people. These folks overcame terrible odds of survival as a movement. The story really should have died off again at that point. For stories built on the memories of poor, itinerant, crucified seditionists generally did not last that long, after all, anyway. Rather, the stories that lasted were usually the ones of the rich and the powerful. And history is often all too often told from that perspective. So as the people kept gathering like in the book of Acts, to keep the story alive, they did so at a great risk. And we stand in that tradition of risk. In fact, within 3 decades after Jesus' death, his brother James, who was leading the early church, and Paul, who was spreading his own Christ story all over the place, they were both executed, along with countless other Jesus followers. Surely now the story will die, right? Surely now the story will die, but alas, it did not. It did not. It just grew wider and farther and more powerful. And even when it took on a life of its own, it just kept growing. In 112, 80 years after Jesus' death, our story continued to unfold in a fascinating letter from a philosopher and Roman governor named Pliny the Younger. He wrote to the emperor, his emperor, Trajan, with a bit of a problem. I love this letter. You see, in Roman society, sacrificing to the gods was a crucial, smooth function of the state. If one did not perform this function, then it was believed the state would suffer from the angry whims of the gods, who would send droughts and fires and plagues and pestilence and all that kind of stuff. And Christians, according to Pliny, these early Christians, were a big problem. In his words, they were stubborn and obstinate. Put that in there. In their refusal to sacrifice, given their belief in one God and Jesus Christ as the Son of God, they just wouldn't do it. So to deal with them, he had a method. Not a very nice method, but he had a method. He would try 3 times to get them to do their duty to sacrifice, torturing them when they refused, and executing them after the 3rd attempt failed. Well, apparently this was becoming a bit of a problem. And Pliny noticed that more and more people were being anonymously accused of being Christians and practicing things like incest and cannibalism and atheism, stealing, and other no-nos of the times. Christians became the favorite scapegoat of the day. So this intrigued him, Pliny. So he did an investigation into what these so-called Christians were really doing. He wanted to know, is any of this true? And what he found out was rather surprising to him. In his letter to the emperor, he writes about what he found. He says this: they meet on a certain day. Think about us, we still do this. They meet on a certain day before light, where they gather and sing hymns to Christ as to a God. He goes on, they oblige themselves by sacrament or oath not to do anything that was ill, but that they would commit no theft or pilfery or adultery, that they would not break their promises or deny what was promised them when it was required back again. Afterwards, it was their custom to depart and to meet again at a common but innocent meal. Pliny found these early Christians were not only not doing the things they were accused of, stealing and other wrongs, but as a part of their gatherings, they were pledging not to do these things. Interestingly, just a little side note, I never really picked up on this letter before, but Pliny also says in the letter that he wanted to verify all of his findings. He wanted to verify it, so he, it's not very nice, he tortured 2 Christian servant maids for the truth. And he says these 2 maids were called deaconesses. This is in a letter from 112. They were called deaconesses, meaning leaders in the early Christian movement. I only include that as a side note, but it looks like women had quite a role in the early church after all, according to the evidence in this letter from Pliny. And that's history, that's not theology or tradition. I'm putting that on the side burner for another sermon, because I think that is fascinating. I think we've all been bamboozled when it's come to women in the church. You all agree? Anyway, okay, our story continues. And Pliny changed how he dealt with these Christians based on the feedback of the Emperor Trajan, and now we have to fast forward in time through the consolidation of this budding Christian movement to the Council of Nicaea and becoming the powerful Catholic Church, and then through the tumult of the Middle Ages to the Reformations. It's a long sweep of history. And finally to a few strands of the Protestant church that were beginning to be infused, as Priscilla said, in early American society some 360 years ago. And what we see in this tour is that these distinct denominations of our own Christian story, the Reformed Church, the Evangelical Church, the Congregational Church, and the Christian Church, before they merged in 1957 to form our United Church of Christ, and afterwards, well, they were all active in pushing the boundaries, just like Jesus did long ago. Well, these denominations were full of all sorts of groundbreaking firsts in the history of Christianity. I love to talk about them. You've heard them before. Bob's smiling because he loves these firsts as well. But they're fantastic firsts in the history of Christianity. Think about that. We have them in our denomination. Besides being the first outspoken anti-slavery voices, our predecessor denominations that formed the UCC held the first acts of civil disobedience when they gathered at Old South Church in Boston and sparked, what do you know it as, the Boston? They published the first African-American poet in 1773. Think about that, 1773, and Phyllis Wheatley. In 1776, they ordained the first African-American, Lemuel Haynes. The first foreign mission society is formed by the Congregationalists, part of our tradition, in 1810. The first school for the deaf is formed in 1817, giving countless numbers of people hope in life. In 1846, they established the first anti-slavery society. In 1853, they ordained the first woman. Anybody know her name? Antoinette Brown. Though Pliny the Younger might have something different to say about that, based on his words on deaconesses, right? In 1972, this applies to us today, big time with these Stoles, the first ever openly gay man, pastor, person, Bill Johnson, was ordained into the United Church of Christ in 2005. And then in 2005, oh, that was 1972, I'm sorry. In 2005, the UCC became the first Christian denomination to pass a resolution supporting marriage equality. We're in a pretty good denomination, aren't we? And as I mentioned, back in 1957, after 30 years of negotiation, these four distinct justice-driven denominations did what is rarely done in this day and age of churches fracturing. They came together, that they may all be one and form the denomination that we tell our story within today on the 60th anniversary of the United Church of Christ. I wanted to take you on this 20th century whirlwind journey to set the tone for the wider story that we are living into today as we celebrate 60 years of being a church. Now, you see, when the UCC formed in 1957, some folks in Cleveland decided that Florida needed a UCC church. So a pastor was chosen, Reverend Richard Davis from Buffalo. And he came on down, and a planning session was held on October 4th. And the first worship service of this yet unnamed spiritual community was held on Sunday, October 11th, 1959, at 10:30 a.m., at the Hellenic Center in Clearwater. Shortly after, a vote was taken, and the church was unanimously named Faith UCC. Land was purchased in Clearwater, and they broke ground, and they built a church and began just like those earliest Christian communities that the book of Acts or Pliny tells us of. They began meeting to sing hymns and pray and break bread and eat meals together and share resources and pledge to do good in the world together. And then our church existed in Clearwater for over 50 years before it was decided to give up that piece of property that we called home for a whole variety of reasons. Now, we could have, like the early church could have, just melted into history, right? And ceased to exist. That would have been so easy. Churches do that all the time. They just shudder and take their ball and they go home. But we did not. We did not. And instead, we moved on into the wilderness, as I like to say. Time of uncertainty, renting space in a Methodist church with a core of folks that were not willing to see this special church pass into history. It was not going to pass away. And then one day, our, Our interim pastor's wife, Carol, was driving down this road right here, 1650 Pinehurst, and she saw it was for sale. The church acted quickly, and they snatched it up, even against the advice of folks who said it was just too small. They took a chance. They took a chance. Many of you are here. Took a chance. They sensed something special here in this land, in this awesome community in Dunedin, and they bought it. And they picked up right where they left off in Clearwater, getting together to pray, to sing hymns, and living the Jesus way in a new home called Faith UCC. These are all the different signs we've had, by the way, up on the screen. That's the story that we celebrate today, my friends, on the 60th anniversary of Faith United Church of Christ. Today, especially after having dedicated our new space last week, we stand at the intersection of our past and our future. They meet here today and we just pause. We pause and we look back and we see an active church that engaged the world through all sorts of ministries and outreach. You all know them. I wasn't even here, but you were living them. You were collecting sleeping bags, right? And doing beans and rice for communities. And you became open and affirming. And you marched in Pride, one of the early denominations or churches to even do that. And you worked with community organizing groups like FAST. And you hosted progressive thinkers like John Shelby Spong and John Dominic Cross, and you brought them into your home. You fixed up apartments at Grace House. You did advocacy through letter writing, and so much more I have learned while looking through all those old photos. Not to mention all the hospitality you guys did over the years. My God, there's a picture that goes by where someone's not gathering to eat something in those books. Seems like you really did emulate the Jesus way when it came to his hospitality. There's always some kind of meal or a bake sale. Just we pause. We pause and we look back and we smile because it was a great past 60 years with so many wonderful people making it so. Many who are no longer with us, many of whom you knew and loved. Then we must also turn. We got to turn. We got to shift our gaze and look forward and envision us continuing the journey of walking the Jesus way in old, but also in new ways. We're feeding the hungry and advocating with protests we've been doing out there on Witness Wednesdays and bringing in groups like PFLAG Dunedin and making sure that they have a home here and Days for Girls, which is now meeting in a new space and working with other community organizing groups and in new ways and speaking out with that new sign that's garnering all sorts of wonderful attention. All of it good so far. I assume that's going to change eventually. Hosting exhibits like Shower of Stoles. Building interfaith bridges, which we've been doing with churches. And mosques. Other places of faith. And leading in progressive theology. And yes, sharing meals together just like they did in the past. And so many more things that we will dream into existence as we live ever deeper into the story that started on those dusty roads, on those riverbanks, on those hillsides, and those gardens around those tables, long ago with a profound prophet in a Galilee far, far away. What a story. Today we celebrate. My God, what a story. You are immersed in the history of one of the greatest stories ever told. The past 60 years have been an amazing journey. The next 60 years will be an amazing journey. Today we stand at the precipice, the intersection, resting for just a moment before we begin our journey to our 120th anniversary. But today let's celebrate, and let's do so boldly. Happy 60th anniversary, Faith United Church of Christ. Here's to 60 more. Let's celebrate it in the fullest. Amen.